heat retention abilities, cooking times may vary slightly. It's a good idea to do a practice run with a single egg and adjust the times as necessary. If you live at a high altitude, a thermometer is essential. 2 quarts water, 1 to 6 large eggs, 12 ice cubes. Pour the water into a lidded 3-quart saucepan and bring to a boil over high heat. Carefully lower the eggs into the water and cook for 30 seconds. Add the ice cubes and allow the water to return to a boil, then reduce to a sub-simmer about 190 degrees Fahrenheit. Cook for 11 minutes. Drain the eggs and peel under cool running water. Poached eggs. What would Eggs Benedict be without perfect soft poached eggs, their snowy whites napped in a robe of gloriously thick, buttery real hollandaise, and liquid golden yolks ready to ooze out over your ham and into the nooks and crannies of your buttered and toasted English muffin? Well, we already know all about soft-boiled eggs, and a poached egg is essentially a soft-boiled egg cooked in the nude. That's the egg, not the cook. This does, of course, introduce all kinds of headaches. How does one keep the white from spreading in the pot of water? How do you prevent the yolk from breaking? How do you get the whole darn thing to keep its shape? Some recommend wrapping eggs in plastic wrap before lowering them into the water to help them retain their shape. The eggs end up with ugly, creased surfaces. Other high-tech methods require hours-long baths and perfectly temperature-controlled water to partially solidify the eggs to help them keep their shape while poaching. I'm not prepared to wake up an extra hour early just to poach my eggs. But take a look at your poached egg problems, then ask yourself a couple of questions. When do your poached eggs work? That answer is easy. When the eggs are fresh. The older an egg gets, the weaker the membrane that surrounds the white becomes, and the more likely it is that your egg will spread when it hits the water. This leads us to our first rule of poached eggs. Use very fresh eggs. What exacerbates the possibility of the white falling apart? Agitation. The more the egg shakes and shimmies, the more likely it is it'll separate. It's standard practice to poach eggs in simmering water. But we already know that eggs will coagulate even at a sub-simmer, so there's no reason to keep the water anywhere near a boil. Bring it up to a boil, then turn the heat off when you add the eggs. But what if you've got fresh eggs and a sub-simmering pot of water, and your eggs still separate and get cloudy? The fact of the matter is that even if you are taking your eggs straight from the chicken and into the pan, you're going to get some spreadage. With a supermarket egg that may have been laid up to 60 days earlier, that's an even bigger risk. How do you get rid of the egg white that's already separated? The solution is an ingenious method that I first saw demonstrated by Heston Blumenthal of the Fat Duck, a restaurant in England. If you crack an egg and transfer it to a fine mesh strainer, all of the loose bits of white will drain through, while the tight white and yolk entrapped by their membrane will stay completely intact. You can then simply lower the strainer into the water. The hot water immediately surrounds the egg and starts the cooking process, and gently slide the egg out into the pan. The result is a perfectly shaped poached egg every time with no floaters. Common poached egg questions. I've read that adding vinegar to the water will help my eggs keep their shape better. Is this true? Yes, sort of. Eggs set up when their proteins denature and coagulate. Egg proteins can be denatured by heat, but they can also be denatured by acid. Adding vinegar to your water indeed causes them to set faster, but the effect is not quick. Rather than causing them to set faster in the short term, which is what you care about, vinegar just causes them to overset as they cook, becoming dry and tough. What's more, vinegar can make your eggs taste, well, vinegary. Does salting make my eggs cook any better? Nope. But there's a good reason to salt your water. It makes your eggs tastier. Just like pasta or potatoes, eggs absorb salt from the water as they cook, leading to a more evenly seasoned finished product. Why are poached eggs so freaking delicious? This is a question that modern science has yet to answer and may well never get around to. Some scientists remark that the lack of progress on this particular front is due to the fact that other scientists don't spend the time to make and enjoy a good breakfast. Should I agitate my eggs as they cook, or swirl the water as I add them, as some books suggest? The strainer-to-pan technique completely eliminates the need to swirl the water before you add the eggs, a trick designed to help the egg keep a nice, even torpedo shape. What you do want to do is to make sure the eggs move around after they've started to set up. If you cook your eggs with no motion at all, they will end up resembling fried eggs in shape, with flat bottoms and a pronounced dome around the yolks. You also run the risk of overcooking the bottoms and toughening them, as they are in direct contact with the hot bottom of the pan. By moving them around in the water and gently flipping them, you get more even cooking and a more even shape. I use a wooden spoon to flip them with the water currents, rather than trying to pick them up with the spoon. Diners have, what, 50 seats in them? How the heck can I serve more than a few eggs at a time? Diners are staffed by superhuman cooking machines known as short-order cooks, who have spent years practicing how to poach eggs perfectly. You want to get that good? One solution. Practice. Okay, there's another way to get there, but don't tell anyone. Promise? Just cook the darn things in advance. Poached eggs can be taken out of the pan right after cooking and transferred to cold water to chill. They'll stay there in a state of suspended animation for as long as you'd like, or as long as they don't begin to rot. You can store them for a few hours or even a few nights in the fridge. Then, 15 minutes before you're ready to serve, just plop them into a bowl of hot water to warm up. Poached eggs, by their very nature, are never very hot. Their yolks would solidify if they were. So 140 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature of hot water straight out of my tap, is just about the perfect temperature for reheating poached eggs. Hollandaise sauce. For many aspiring French chefs, great hollandaise is the bane of their existence. Far removed from the gloppy, greasy stuff you get at the typical diner, or worse, the powdered, just-add-milk cafeteria version, a true hollandaise is creamy and rich, impossibly smooth, and perfectly well-balanced with the flavors of egg, butter, and a touch of lemon juice. It should flow slowly off a spoon so that it naps a poached egg in a thick robe. Never runny, and certainly never curdled, hollandaise has a delicate texture that's really tough to get right. At least, it used to be. I've figured out a way to make it perfectly every single time, even with no experience. Hollandaise sauce, just like mayonnaise, is an egg-stabilized emulsion of fat in a water-based liquid. It's traditionally made by cooking egg yolks with a little water, whisking them constantly until they've just begun to set, then slowly drizzling in melted clarified butter and seasoning the sauce with lemon juice. With various whisking, the butterfat gets broken up into microscopic droplets that are surrounded by the water from the lemon juice and the egg yolks. Both the acid in the lemon juice and the protein lecithin in the egg yolks prevent these fat droplets from coalescing and breaking down into a greasy pool. The result is a thick, creamy, delicious sauce. Mayonnaise is relatively simple. It's made from a liquid fat, oil, and it's made and kept at room or fridge temperatures. Hollandaise is more complicated. Butterfat begins to solidify below 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you let your hollandaise get too cool, the solid chunks of fat will break the emulsion, turning it grainy. Reheat it, and it will separate into a greasy liquid. That's why leftover hollandaise can't be stored. On the other hand, if you let it get too hot, the egg proteins will begin to coagulate. You'll end up with a lumpy, curdled sauce with the texture of soft scrambled eggs. So the keys to a perfect hollandaise are two: careful construction of an emulsion by slowly incorporating butterfat into the liquid, and temperature control. Once you realize this, the solution to foolproofing hollandaise becomes quite simple. Most classic recipes require you to heat both the butter and egg yolks before trying to combine the two. But what if you were to just heat one of them so that when it is combined with the other, the final temperature ends up in the correct range? I figured that if I heated my butter to a high enough temperature, I should be able to slowly incorporate it into a mixture of raw egg yolks and lemon juice, gradually raising its temperature, so that by the time all the butter is incorporated, the yolks are cooked exactly how they need to be. Because the acidity of lemon juice can minimize curdling, there's a little bit of leeway as far as temperature is concerned. Anywhere in the 160 degrees to 180 degrees Fahrenheit range for the finished sauce will work. To test the theory, I heated up a couple of sticks of butter on the stovetop, the microwave also does just fine, to 200 degrees Fahrenheit, then slowly drizzled the butter into my egg yolks and lemon juice, which I had running in the blender. Adding a bit of water to the yolk mixture helps prevent it from sticking to the walls of the jar. A quick dash of salt and cayenne pepper, and there it was. Perfect hollandaise without the headache. To make it even more foolproof, I tried it again using an immersion blender and its jar. I put the egg yolks, lemon, and water in the jar, stuck the wand of the hand blender down in there, poured in all the melted butter, and turned on the blender. As the vortex drew butter down into the whirling blades, a thick, stable emulsion formed like magic, until all the butter was incorporated and my sauce was thick, rich, and light, the way a great hollandaise should be. Clarified butter. Solid butter may look like a single, homogeneous substance, but melted in a pan, and it quickly becomes apparent that it's made up of a few different things. Butterfat makes up around 80% of the weight of butter, up to 84% for some high-end European-style butters, or as low as 65% for some fresh-churned farm-stand-style butters. Because there are many different fats that make up butterfat, each one of which softens and melts at a specific temperature range, butter goes through many textural changes as you heat it, slowly softening and becoming more and more malleable until finally, at around 95 degrees Fahrenheit, all of the fats are liquefied. Water makes up another 15%, down to 11% for high-end butters, up to 30% for fresh-churned butters. In the cool environs of the fridge, the water and fat in a stick of butter commingle without any problem. But apply some energy to the situation by heating it in a skillet, and eventually the water converts to steam, forming small bubbles of vapor and causing your butter to foam. Once the foaming has subsided, you know that all of the water has made its escape and your butter has begun to climb above 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Since water is denser than fat, when butter is melted in a large pot, this layer of water and a few dissolved proteins will sink to the bottom, where it will begin to bubble if heated long enough. Milk proteins, mainly casein, make up the remaining 5% or so of the butter. These proteins are the milky white scum that floats to the top of your butter as you melt it, and it's these proteins that will begin to brown and eventually burn and smoke as you heat butter in a hot skillet. Because of its water and protein content, plain butter is not the ideal medium for searing food. It simply can't get hot enough without burning. For this reason, many chefs make clarified butter, butter from which the water and protein have been removed. It's the primary cooking fat in India, where it's known as ghee. You make it by melting butter, carefully skimming the white milk proteins off the top, and then pouring off the golden liquid fat, discarding the watery layer of proteins on the bottom. Once clarified, butter can be heated to much higher temperatures without fear of burning. As I mentioned earlier, clarified butter is used to make a classic hollandaise, the thinking being that the water constituent in whole butter will dilute the sauce. A much easier way to avoid this water in your finished sauce is to just pour the melted butter slowly out of the pan until all that's left is the watery layer at the bottom, which you can then discard. Fried eggs. If you're like me, mastering fried eggs was your very first culinary accomplishment. Or, I should say, fried eggs were my very first attempt at accomplishing something in the kitchen. Because, truth be told, the eggs were never the same twice. This is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, if I'd been taking notes on exactly how and why my eggs were never the same way twice, I'd call that science. I'd also most likely have developed a good technique years earlier. Remember that egg whites start setting at around 155 degrees Fahrenheit, while egg yolks start firming up as low as 145 degrees Fahrenheit. This gives us the rather tricky problem of trying to cook two different components of one food in the same cooking medium at completely different rates. It's not an easy trick to pull off, but it can be done. We already know one thing for sure. If you want your eggs to be picture perfect, the yolk standing tall, ready to be pierced by a fork so that their golden treasure cascades slowly across a plane of tight, clean whites, their edges showing just a bare hint of crispness, you have to start with the freshest possible eggs. Draining the eggs in a fine mesh strainer, just like you did for poached eggs, aids in achieving this result. Though personally, I kinda like the bubbly, thin whites that spread around the pan and become extra crisp as they cook. Picture-perfect fried eggs are for advertisements. A tight, tall yolk isn't just about looking good. With fresh eggs, the yolks are kept elevated above the hot surface of the pan, allowing them to set a little bit more slowly than the whites. This is key if you want your whites opaque before your yolks get hard. What else can you do to keep the yolks from overcooking? Well, here's another thing we know. Egg yolks contain far more fat than egg whites. Luckily for us here, fat is an excellent insulator. That is, it transfers energy less efficiently than water does. That's why whales are covered in blubber. We can use this fact to our advantage by adjusting the pan temperature. I cooked eggs in three different pans at three different heat settings just until the whites were set. Over low heat, the yolks came out completely firm and chalky at the bottom, with just a very thin layer of barely liquid yolk at the top. The whites were extremely rubbery and dry in all but the thickest part just around the yolk. With gentle heat and an extended cooking time, the differences in conductivity between the egg yolks and the egg whites don't have as strong an effect on their cooking rates. They basically cook in the same time. Additionally, the egg whites were pure white, with no crisping or browning at all on the bottom surface. Some folks like their egg whites this way. I think those people secretly just want poached eggs. Over medium heat, there was still a good amount of liquid yolk at the top of the egg, while the bottom half of the yolk became quite firm. The whites took on a touch of browning, even more if I used butter instead of oil. The milk proteins in the butter brown and stick to the eggs. This is a good compromise for folks who like some liquid yolk, but don't want their whites to show any transparency at all. Over high heat, you can get whites that are completely set with yolks that are still almost completely liquid, but you run into another problem. The bottom of the eggs burns long before the rest of the egg is ready to eat. For the simplest fried eggs, moderate heat is the way to go. Whether you're using butter or oil makes little difference in the cooking, as long as you make sure that the milk proteins in your butter don't burn before you slip the eggs into the pan. It's best to add them just after the foaming subsides. This is an indication that the water in the butter has completely evaporated and the pan is somewhere in the 250 degree Fahrenheit range. Butter will give you richer flavor and deeper browning, while oil will give you cleaner egg flavor and slightly crispier bottoms. It's all down to personal preference. For a long time, I was happy with my medium heat eggs, sacrificing a bit of liquid yolk for the extra crispness in the whites. But then I saw a technique in Spain that made me rethink the way I fried eggs. There, it's common to fry eggs not in a thin layer of fat, but in a shallow pool of it. Cooks would fill the pan with a half inch or so of olive oil and heat it up to deep frying temperatures, then tilt the pan so the fat collected on one side, drop in the eggs, and baste them with the hot fat as they cooked. The eggs cooked quite rapidly from all sides, the whites quickly setting and transforming into a delicately lacy, lightly frizzled shell around the still liquid yolk. What if I were to adapt part of this technique to my fried eggs at home? By heating up a few tablespoons of oil in a skillet, I use non-stick or a good cast iron pan, I can get a similar effect by then adding my eggs and using a spoon to baste the whites with the hot oil. The whites puff and crisp, setting rapidly, while leaving the yolk just barely heated through. It's my new favorite way to eat fried eggs, especially when I go for it and use the fancy pants olive oil. Scrambled eggs, two ways. There's a big divide in the world of scrambled eggs between those who like them rich, dense, and creamy, that's me, and those who like them light, relatively dry, and fluffy, that's my wife. This is the kind of stuff that can really tear a home apart. So in the interest of maintaining marital bliss, I decided that it was only right that I figured out how to make both types of scrambled eggs so that we could both enjoy our breakfast. Just like with boiled eggs, cooking scrambled eggs is all about controlling the coagulation of egg proteins, the difference being that with scrambled eggs, not only are the proteins in the whites and yolks mixed together, but you also have the opportunity to mix in additional ingredients, as well as to control the way the eggs come together by moving them as they cook. For my testing, I decided to begin with just plain eggs in order to gauge the effects of stirring and other mechanical actions. The only additive I used was a bit of butter in the pan to prevent them from sticking. A few things became clear immediately. The difference between creamy scrambled eggs and fluffy ones has mostly to do with the amount of air they contain at the end. As beaten eggs are heated in a skillet, their proteins begin to set. At the same time, the moisture within them begins to evaporate, causing pockets of steam and air to build up within the eggs. Vigorous stirring or shaking will cause these pockets of steam and air to rupture, making the eggs denser. So, for the fluffiest scrambled eggs, your goal is to minimize the movement of the eggs in the pan, gently folding and turning them just enough to get them to cook evenly into large, golden, tender curds. For creamy eggs, constant stirring is preferable to remove excess air and get the egg proteins to set up closely with one another, resulting in a dense, almost custard-like scramble. Heat had a great effect on final texture as well. When cooked over very low heat, even gently folded eggs won't get too fluffy. This is because there's not enough energy in the pan to cause water vapor to form or to cause air bubbles to expand vigorously. So, for fluffy scrambled eggs, you need to use relatively high heat, though if you let the pan get too hot, you risk overcooking, or worse, browning your eggs. While for creamy eggs, cooking over low heat gives you much more control over their texture. Additives. What about common additions to eggs? Water, milk, and the like. There are basically two things they can do. First, they add some water to the mix, which makes for fluffier eggs. More water equals more vaporization. Dairy ingredients also add fat, which can impede egg proteins from linking with each other, creating a more tender curd. The chart in the bonus PDF sums it all up. With all this data, my fluffy scrambled eggs were coming out great. I just had to make sure to whisk in some milk along with the eggs, to use relatively high heat, to keep the stirring and folding minimal, and to make sure to get them out of the hot pan before they were completely cooked. Even once out of the pan, moisture will continue to evaporate from the eggs, and the proteins will continue to set tighter and tighter. Removing the eggs from the pan when slightly undercooked ensures that they arrive at the table perfectly cooked. My creamy eggs, on the other hand, were giving me more problems. They were coming out fine when I started them with cubes of cold butter, used low heat, and stirred constantly to break up curds and release air and vapor, but they were still not quite as rich and creamy as I'd like. Salting them well before cooking and letting them rest helped, but if there's one thing I learned working in French restaurants, it's that when all else fails, add more fat. My solution was to add extra egg yolks to the mix, as well as to finish the dish with a touch of heavy cream. The cream serves two functions. It adds richness and smooths out the egg's texture, and when added at the end of cooking, it also cools them down, preventing them from setting up too hard in the skillet. And how's this for gilding the lily? Use creme fraiche in place of heavy cream. The resulting eggs are the ultimate in luxury. Rich, tender, almost custard-like in texture. Eggceptional! Sorry. Salting eggs. Here's the scenario. You've just beaten a few eggs with a pinch of salt, getting ready to scramble them, when suddenly the dog gets stuck in the toilet, your mother-in-law calls, and the UPS guy rings the doorbell to deliver your brand new digital thermometer. 30 minutes later, you get back to those eggs and realize they've completely changed color. Once bright yellow and opaque, they're now dark orange and translucent. What's going on? And, more important, will it affect the way they cook? Salt affects eggs by weakening the magnetic attraction that yolk proteins have for one another. Yes, egg proteins do find each other attractive. Egg yolks are comprised of millions of tiny balloons filled with water, protein, and fat. These balloons are too small to see with the naked eye, but they are large enough to prevent light from passing through them. Salt breaks these spheres up into even tinier pieces, allowing light to pass through, so the salted eggs turned translucent. What does this mean for the way they cook? To find out, I cooked 3 batches of eggs side by side, noting their finished texture. Salting timing, 15 minutes prior to cooking. Results: the least watery and the most tender, with moist, soft curds. Salting timing, just before cooking. Results: moderately tender and not watery. Salting timing, toward the end of cooking. Results: toughest of the three, with a tendency to weep liquid onto the plate. Turns out that salt can have quite a drastic effect on how eggs cook. When eggs cook and coagulate, the proteins in the yolks pull tighter and tighter together as they get hotter. When they get too tight, they begin to squeeze liquid out from the curds, resulting in eggs that weep in a most embarrassing manner. Adding salt to the eggs well before cooking can prevent the proteins from bonding too tightly by reducing their attraction to one another, resulting in a more tender curd and less likelihood of unattractive weeping. Adding salt immediately before cooking helps, but to get the full effect, the salt must have time to dissolve and become evenly distributed through the mixture. This takes about 15 minutes, just enough time for you to get your bacon cooked. Homemade creme fraiche. Creme fraiche is made by allowing heavy cream to spoil in a controlled way. Bacteria introduced into the cream convert some of its sugar, mainly the complex carbohydrate lactose, into simple sugars and acidic byproducts. This lowers the pH of the cream, causing some of its proteins to coagulate, making it thicker. Good creme fraiche has a rich, creamy texture, stiff enough to form loose peaks, and a tangy, slightly cheese-like flavor. Store-bought creme fraiche is great, but it can be difficult to track down and pricey. When I found out that you can simply mix buttermilk, which has live bacterial culture, into heavy cream and let it thicken overnight to create a true creme fraiche at home, my mind was blown. I like to share my mind-blowing experiences, so here you go. Lucky you! I played around with the ratios of cream to buttermilk quite a bit, and in the end found that it doesn't really matter all that much. Add more buttermilk, and you'll need less time for it to thicken, but it'll be less creamy. Add less, and it takes longer, but tastes better. 1 tablespoon per cup, that's a 1 to 16 ratio, was about the perfect balance for me. It gets super rich and creamy at right about the 12-hour mark. You can halt the process earlier by refrigerating it to stop the bacterial action. This is useful if you want a thinner Mexican-style crema agria for drizzling over your nachos or guacamole. For those of you worried about cream spoiling at room temp, that's the idea. It's the good bacteria from the buttermilk multiplying in there that prevents the dangerous bacteria from taking over. And let the mind-blowing begin. Commence countdown. Easy homemade creme fraiche. Makes 2 cups. 2 cups heavy cream, 2 tablespoons buttermilk. Combine the heavy cream and buttermilk in a glass jar or bowl. Cover and allow to rest at room temperature until thickened to the desired texture, 6 to 12 hours. Store in the refrigerator in a sealed container for up to 2 weeks. Omelets. Just as with scrambled eggs, there are 2 major types of omelet. The hearty, big as your face, stuffed to the brim, fluffy, folded in half, light, golden brown, diner-style omelet, and its refined French cousin, the moist, tender, pale yellow variety, gently rolled like the world's most delicious cigar. And, just as with scrambled eggs, the method by which the eggs are heated and stirred is the primary factor that determines what you end up with. For fluffy, diner-style omelets, the key is to start the eggs in hot butter and move them as little as possible during cooking. Rather than shaking the pan and breaking up the large curds, the best course of action is a move called the lift and tilt. Use a silicone spatula to lift up the edges of the omelet and push them toward the center of the pan while tilting it to allow the raw egg to run underneath. Repeating this technique means nearly all of the eggs can be set with minimal stirring. You'll still end up with a slick of raw egg across the top surface, which is easy to take care of. Remove the skillet from the heat, add whatever toppings you like, ham and cheese are my favorite, cover it with a lid, and let the residual heat from the eggs gently cook the top through, then fold it in half and serve. A tender, fancy pants omelet, the kind I remember watching Jacques Pepin make look so easy, can be made by cooking the eggs fast, but it's one of the most difficult techniques in cooking. Really. Luckily, though, it doesn't actually require fast cooking. And once you've learned the cold butter cube trick you picked up with the creamy scrambled eggs to help regulate the cooking temperature, you can actually make a tender French-style omelet in much the same manner, with slow cooking and constant stirring. The only difficult part about this style of omelet is the rolling. The trick is to make sure that one side of the egg disc is thicker than the other by wrapping the pan sharply against the stove as you finish cooking so that the eggs collect on the end opposite the handle. Then let the bottom set slightly, and the omelet can be rolled up, starting at the thinner edge, before being turned out onto a plate. Bacon. If there's one sure way to guarantee a relapse in an on-the-fence vegetarian, it's to dangle a strip of crisply fried bacon in front of him. I sometimes think that the only thing keeping my marriage harmonious is the unduly large number of makeup points I get every time I bring my wife bacon in bed. These days, I'm pretty good at cooking it, if I do say so myself, but this was not always the case. My bacon used to have a severe case of bipolar disorder, crispy and burnt in some spots, flaccid, rubbery, and undercooked in others. Achieving perfectly crisp, evenly cooked bacon is all about patience. You see, bacon is made up of 2 distinct elements, the fat, which is actually a mixture of fat and connective tissue, and the lean, and each cooks differently. Fat tends to shrink quickly when heated, but after the initial shrinking stage, it takes quite a bit of time to finish cooking, as the connective tissue that remains is slowly broken down. Undercooked connective tissue is what causes rubbery bacon. The lean, on the other hand, shrinks less than the fat, and because of this differential, your bacon twists and buckles, just like the bimetal strip inside a thermostat. This twisting, in turn, exacerbates the situation because not only are your fat and lean shrinking at different rates, but entire sections of the strip are now cooking at different rates, depending on whether or not they are in direct contact with the pan. By cooking bacon over low heat, the shrinkage differential can be minimized, keeping your bacon flatter and allowing it to cook more evenly. A large, heavy skillet with even heat distribution is essential. Want to cook bacon for a crowd? Do it in the oven. An oven heats much more evenly than a skillet does, delivering perfectly crisp bacon by the trayful. Wet versus dry cures. By now, you must have seen that highfalutin bacon that seems to be invading every farmer's market and supermarket in the country, not to mention online sources. Is it worth its premium price? As far as flavor is concerned, that's simply a matter of personal preference. But there's a far more compelling reason to pick the fancy stuff over the standard supermarket brands, and it's in the cure. All bacon is cured, that is, treated with salt in order to alter the structure of its proteins and preserve it. Traditionally, the cure was a dry cure. Salt, often with other seasonings, was rubbed onto slabs of pork belly. Over the course of a few weeks, the salt worked its way into the belly at a leisurely pace while the meat slowly lost moisture. The result was a dense hunk of deeply flavored belly with relatively little residual moisture. Many high-end bacons are now produced using this time-consuming method. Most supermarket bacons, on the other hand, are cured with a wet cure. A salt water solution is injected into the meat in many spots. With this technique, the salt can penetrate the meat much faster. What once took weeks is accomplished in a matter of days. Of course, with the injection of added water and insufficient time to dry, this short-cut bacon is far wetter than dry-cured bacon, with two results. First, it means that you're paying more for it than meets the eye. That 1-pound package contains at least an ounce or two of added water weight. Second, and more important, it won't cook the same way. Try it. Fry a piece of regular supermarket bacon side by side with a strip of high-end dry-cured bacon. The supermarket bacon will shrink and curl considerably more than the dry-cured bacon as its moisture evaporates. It'll also split and sputter far more due to the excess water droplets it's expelling as it cooks. So, putting flavor aside, if you're constantly enraged by bacon grease sputtering onto your stovetop, or that darn strip that just won't lie flat, you may want to consider switching to a bacon produced the traditional way, with a dry cure. Crispy potato cake, aka roasty. Crispy and golden brown on the outside, creamy and tender in the middle, with some good garlicky mayo, aioli if you will, for dipping, the key to really great roasty is balancing the amount of starch that the finished potato cake retains. Too little starch, and it falls apart. Too much, and it comes out sticky. Potato cells contain their own starch, so this really becomes a question of how to cut the potatoes in order to release just the right amount. You can grate them on a box grater or in the food processor, but if you do, you'll end up rupturing potato cells, releasing a ton of liquid and starch from inside them. Then you're forced to squeeze the shreds dry, and your roasty will come out starchy and sticky, even with relatively low-starch potatoes like Yukon Golds. Much better, though slightly more difficult, is to cut them on a mandolin. If you have one with extra teeth or blades, which you should, it'll cut the potatoes directly into 1/16-inch shreds for you. If you don't, it's easy enough to slice the potatoes into thin planks and then use a knife to get the matchsticks you need. A sharp mandolin and a sharp knife equals fewer ruptured cells, equals less sticky starch release, equals better texture and more potato flavor in each bite. Some sources recommend rinsing the cut potatoes to rid them completely of their starch, then adding a measured amount of pure potato starch to them before cooking. But I find the results unsatisfactory. Rinsed potatoes don't soften properly when cooked, and you end up with roasty with al dente bits of crunchy potato inside. The other key to great roasty is to par-cook the potatoes before frying them. Why? Well, anybody who's worked the French fry station at a restaurant knows that potatoes begin to oxidize as soon as you cut them. Over the course of 15 minutes or so, a cut potato will go from being pale white to reddish brown and eventually to black. You don't want your potatoes to be black. Storing sliced potatoes in water will prevent this from happening, or at least slow it down, but it also rinses away lots of starch. Too little starch is just as bad as too much starch in roasty, so I avoid rinsing or submerging my taters in water at any point. Par cooking the potatoes accomplishes the goal of preventing them from browning and also leads to a better texture in the finished product. You don't have to worry about raw potato in the center of the potato cake. This is one case where the microwave is actually the best tool for the job. It allows you to cook the potatoes rapidly without either adding moisture or losing an excessive amount. For a gussied-up version, I sauté onions and mushrooms until a deep golden brown and flavor them with a bit of thyme to form a central layer in my potato cake. You could use whatever sautéed vegetables you want. After you've got your stuffing, if any, cooking the roasty is a simple matter of moderate heat and a good thick pan that will cook it gently and evenly. I use a well-seasoned cast-iron pan, but you can use a good non-stick pan if you don't have a cast-iron one. Crisping the potatoes properly takes a while, which gives you plenty of time to brew your coffee or squeeze your mangoes or prepare whatever else it is your spouse likes served with their brunch. Potato hash. Hash is the kind of breakfast that happens when I plan to go grocery shopping on a Friday night. This is never a good idea. Let me give you an idea of how it works. The plan. I wake up Friday morning, fresh and dewy-faced, ready for a full day of work, followed by a trip to New York Mart for some produce, a quick subway ride home, and a few hours of cooking. My wife gets home, we enjoy dinner, play a couple rounds of online Jeopardy, catch an episode of How I Met Your Mother, and hit the sack early, ready to face a hearty breakfast in the morning. The reality. I wake up Friday morning, barely over a cold from earlier in the week, head in for a day at work, get caught in meetings all morning before finally getting to start my real work in the late afternoon, don't get as much done as I hoped, and say, "Screw it, it's Friday, time for happy hour." Rather than go grocery shopping, I get a cocktail, then realize that New York Mart is now closed, acknowledge the grave error I've made in my meal planning, and send down another cocktail to keep the first one company. My wife ends up meeting me downtown for another cocktail, followed by dinner out, that's a bottle of wine and an after-dinner drink, and since we've already made a night of it, we might as well really make a night of it. Next thing I know, it's noon on Saturday, the dog needs to be walked, and I've got nothing but a few potatoes, a couple of eggs, and some random leftovers in my pantry to nurse us back to good health. Thank God for hash, right? Hash is the ultimate leftover consumer. All you need is a starchy root vegetable to form the base. Potatoes are the usual choice, but sweet potatoes or beets are great too. Whatever leftovers you have on hand, cooked meat, greens, vegetables, whatever, a good cast-iron skillet, and a couple of eggs, and you've got the makings of a breakfast that will frighten any hangover into quiet submission. As I mentioned for my roasty recipes, the best way to get a good, fluffy, crisp texture out of your potatoes is to boil them, dry them, and then fry them. This allows the oil to penetrate a little deeper, increases the surface area by causing the potatoes to blister, and makes for a far crisper finished product. But who's got the time for all that when there's a headache that needs tending to? Instead, it's much easier to slice the potatoes, put them on a plate, and microwave them for the initial cooking step, as I do for roasty. This'll let you soften them and cook them through without having to worry about them getting waterlogged or too wet on the exterior, and what takes 10 minutes in a pot takes under 3 minutes in the nuker. Once they are par-cooked, I add the potatoes to a hot skillet to begin the crisping, charring process while I roughly chop up my vegetables, in this case, peppers and onions. In a hazy stupor, I've tried tossing the par-cooked potatoes and other vegetables together before adding them to the skillet. But that is an exceedingly bad idea, resulting in burnt onions and none too crisp potatoes. You need to give the taters a head start on the rest of the vegetables, only adding the veg once a crisp crust has developed. By the way, don't ever feel like you're limited in what you can put into a good breakfast hash. Cabbages, like bok choy or Brussels sprouts, develop an awesomely sweet, nutty flavor as they char. Cured meats like pastrami or corned beef will crisp nicely, their fat flavoring the potatoes as they cook. Shallots and onions turn sweet and complex, while green vegetables like broccoli or asparagus get nicely charred and tender. By the time the potatoes are completely crisp, the peppers and onions in this one are perfectly tender and sweet, and the hangover has begun to emit a faint, high-pitched whimper of fear. The nail in the coffin? A dash of hot sauce, which adds not only a touch of heat, but, more important, vinegar to brighten things up. All the awesome smells emanating from the skillet are enough to work my appetite up into a near frenzy, so a couple of eggs in the mix are a no-brainer. You can fry your eggs in a separate skillet, but it's much easier just to make a couple of wells in the hash, crack your eggs directly into the pan, and finish the whole thing off in the oven until the whites are just barely set, but the yolk's still runny. Start to finish, it takes under 15 minutes, which means it's hot and on the table all before my wife is even back with the dog. A great way to start your Saturday afternoon, bright and early. Buttermilk pancakes. They may be golden brown, crisp on the edges, and light and fluffy in the center, but when you get right down to it, classic American pancakes are not all that different from any leavened bread. Apart from its starch content, bread is basically just a ball of protein filled with gas, very much like my dog in that respect. When flour is mixed with liquid, two proteins naturally present in wheat, glutenin and gliadin, link together to form the resilient, stretchy protein matrix known as gluten. In leavened breads, air bubbles are formed in this matrix and expand, creating the familiar hole structure inside a loaf of bread, or a good pizza crust for that matter. With traditional or slow breads, that leavening agent is a living fungus called yeast. As the yeast consumes sugars present in the flour, it releases carbon dioxide gas, forming thousands of teeny tiny air pockets inside the dough and causing it to rise. Once you pop that dough into the oven, those air pockets heat up and further expand, and a phenomenon known as oven spring takes place. Finally, as the gluten and starches get hot enough, they set into a semi-solid form, giving structure to the bread and turning it from wet and stretchy to dry and spongy. The only problem with yeast? It takes a long, long time to work. Enter baking soda. Unrestricted by the protracted time frames of biological organisms, it relies instead on the quick chemical reaction between an acid and a base. Baking soda is pure sodium bicarbonate, an alkaline, aka basic powder. When dissolved in liquid and combined with an acid, it rapidly reacts, breaking down into sodium, water, and carbon dioxide. Just as with yeasted breads, this carbon dioxide expands upon baking, leavening the gluten protein matrix. This type of chemically leavened bread is referred to as a quick bread, a broad category that includes everything from scones and biscuits to banana or zucchini bread and even pancakes. Of course, for baking soda to work, a recipe needs to include a significant acidic ingredient. That's why you see so many classic recipes for buttermilk pancakes and buttermilk biscuits or cake recipes that contain vinegar. The buttermilk is not just a flavoring agent. It provides the necessary acid to react with the baking soda and leaven the bread. Around the middle of the 19th century, someone realized that rather than relying on the home cook to add an acidic ingredient to react with the baking soda, it'd be much simpler to add a powdered acid directly to the baking soda itself, and baking powder was born. Composed of baking soda, a powdered acid, and a starch to absorb moisture and prevent the acid or base from reacting prematurely, baking powder was marketed as the all-in-one solution for busy housewives. In its dry state, it's totally inert. But once you add a liquid, the powdered acid and base dissolve and react with each other, creating bubbles of carbon dioxide without the need for an external acid source. Neat, right? But hold on, there's more. Side effects. The most interesting side effect of using baking soda in a recipe is that it affects browning in a major way. The Maillard reaction, named after Louis Camille Maillard, who first described its processes in the early 20th century, is the set of reactions responsible for that beautiful brown crust on your steak and the deep color of a good loaf of bread. Aside from cosmetics, the reaction also produces hundreds of aromatic compounds that add an inimitable savoriness and complexity to foods. As it turns out, the reaction occurs better in alkaline environments, which means that once you've added enough baking soda to neutralize the acid in a batter or dough, any extra you add will work to increase browning. So I made 5 batches of pancakes using identical batters consisting of flour, baking powder, egg, buttermilk, melted butter, salt, and sugar, and varying amounts of baking soda, starting with none, and increasing it by 1/8 teaspoon increments up to a full 1/2 teaspoon per batch. Each pancake was cooked on a preheated griddle for exactly 1.5 minutes per side. The results very clearly demonstrate the browning effect of baking soda. A pale and bland pancake is inordinately acidic due to the unneutralized buttermilk. It is also under-risen, with a flat, dense texture. A pancake with a full 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda in the batter has the opposite problem. It browns far too quickly, lending it an acrid, burnt flavor tinged with a soapy chemical aftertaste of unneutralized baking soda. Interestingly enough, this pancake was also flat and dense. The large amount of baking soda reacted too violently when mixed into the batter. The carbon dioxide bubbles inflated too rapidly, and, like an overfilled balloon, the pancake popped, becoming dense and flaccid as it cooked. This browning phenomenon isn't just limited to pancakes, of course. For example, cookie recipes routinely include baking soda to aid browning, even when there isn't an acid for it to react with. Double bubble. If there's one major drawback with chemically leavened breads, it's that they need to be cooked pretty much immediately after the batter is mixed. Unlike a yeasted bread dough, which is low in moisture and kneaded until a tough, elastic gluten network forms to trap the massive amounts of carbon dioxide produced, a quick bread must be made with an extremely moist batter. Baking powder simply doesn't produce enough gas to effectively leaven a thicker dough. Batters have relatively little gluten formation, meaning that they aren't all that great at trapping and holding bubbles. Once you mix a batter, your baking soda or baking powder immediately begins producing gas, and that gas almost immediately begins trying to escape into the air. When working with quick breads, those who aren't into the whole brevity thing may run into difficulties. Cook your pancakes immediately after mixing, and you get a light, tall, fluffy interior. Let the batter sit for 30 minutes, and you get a dense, gummy interior with few bubbles. But wait a minute. There are still some bubbles in there, right? Where did those come from? Well, pretty much all baking powder is what is referred to as double acting. Just as the name indicates, it produces gas in 2 distinct phases. The first occurs as soon as you mix it with water. The second occurs only when it is heated. This second rise in the skillet makes for extra light and fluffy pancakes. The whites are light. So what if baking soda just isn't doing enough for you? How do you get your pancakes to stand even taller and lighter? I like to use a meringue, Egg whites that have been whipped vigorously until they form a semi-solid foam. Here's how it works. Foam. In the early phases of beating, the proteins in the egg whites, mostly globulin and ovotransferrin, begin to unfold. Like nerds at a Star Wars convention, they tend to gather together and bond in small groups. The whites start to incorporate a few bubbles and resemble seafoam. Soft peaks. As the whites are beaten, the groups of bonded egg proteins become more and more interconnected, eventually creating a continuous network of proteins that reinforce the walls of the bubbles you are creating. The whites begin to form soft peaks. Stiff peaks. As you continue to beat, the reinforced bubbles are broken into smaller and smaller bubbles, becoming so small that they are nearly invisible to the naked eye, and thus the whites appear smooth and white, like shaving cream. When pulled into peaks, they remain stiff and solid. Breakdown and weeping. Keep going past the stiff peak stage, and the proteins begin to bond so tightly with each other that they squeeze the moisture right out of the bubbles, resulting in a meringue that weeps and breaks. Acidic ingredients like cream of tartar or a touch of lemon juice can prevent egg white proteins from bonding too tightly, allowing you to form a foam that stays stable no matter how hard you beat it. Add sugar and vanilla to the whites at the soft peak stage, whip to stiff peaks, drop by the spoonful onto baking sheets, and bake at low temperature, and you've got yourself classic meringue cookies. If you instead drizzle in a cooked sugar syrup toward the end of whipping, you'll end up with what's called an Italian meringue, a meringue that stays soft and supple even when browned, the kind of thing you'd want to top a lemon meringue pie with. Here, the use for meringue is much more simple. All you're going to do is fold it into the pancake batter. The extra air that the egg whites have incorporated expands as the pancakes cook, making them feather light. Pancake flavor. As far as flavoring buttermilk pancakes go, there are a few givens. Dairy fat, in the form of melted butter or milk, is essential. Not only does it add richness and flavor to the mix, but by coating the flour and limiting gluten development, it also ensures that your pancakes remain tender. Eggs help set the pancakes as they cook, as well as provide some extra lift. Buttermilk is obviously part of the equation, but I like my pancakes extra tangy, and straight-up buttermilk just doesn't cut it for me. Increasing the quantity doesn't work. That just ends up throwing the liquid-to-solid ratio out of whack. Instead, I replace part of the buttermilk with a good amount of sour cream. It's both less moist than buttermilk and more sour, which allows me to add acidity without watering down the batter. If you don't have sour cream on hand, don't worry. The pancakes will still taste just fine with straight-up buttermilk. Homemade ricotta. Newsflash. Store-bought ricotta is almost invariably awful. True ricotta is made by adding acid to heated whey, typically the whey left over from the production of Pecorino Romano, although other kinds of whey are sometimes used. Ricotta means recooked, referring to the reheated whey. The combination of heat and acid causes milk proteins, mainly casein, to bind together, trapping moisture and fat and forming soft white curds. To make high-quality ricotta, these curds are then carefully removed from the whey, too much mechanical action can turn them rubbery, and allowed to drain, reducing their water content and concentrating their flavor and richness. The result is mind-blowingly simple, yet decadent. Or at least it should be. The reality is that pretty much all mass-market ricotta producers don't bother to take the time to drain their cheese properly. Instead, they load the stuff up with gums and stabilizers intended to keep the water, and thus their profits, from leaking out. What you get is a gritty, gluey, rubbery paste. No thank you. Homemade ricotta, though, when made right, is creamy and tender, with a mild, milky flavor and a slight tang from the acid used to curdle it. In fact, I like ricotta made at home with whole milk better than a traditional low-fat, whey-produced ricotta. How do you like that? With homemade ricotta, the single most important variable in terms of both flavor and texture is the acid you add to the mix. Buttermilk has many advocates who claim it's the tastiest acid of choice. I had problems with it. In order to get the milk to curdle properly, I had to add buttermilk at nearly a 1-to-4 ratio, resulting in a final product with a very distinct sour flavor. It wasn't bad, per se, but the flavor certainly limited its applications. I couldn't imagine stuffing it into ravioli, for instance. And the curd structure was also ever so slightly overdeveloped, giving the ricotta a sticky texture. Distilled vinegar gives the cleanest flavor, with soft, tender curds. Since bottled vinegar is always diluted to 5% acetic acid, using it is also the most consistent method. As long as your milk is fresh, older milk is more acidic than fresh milk and thus requires less coagulant, you'll get identical results every time. Lemon juice also works very well, though I found that in some cases, the amount I needed to use varied by about 25%, give or take. Most likely, this is due to varying pH levels from lemon to lemon. Lemon juice gives the ricotta a very slight citrus tang that, while not as distinct as the buttermilk flavor, can be slightly off-putting in certain savory applications. On the other hand, it's wonderful for pancakes and blintzes, or feeding to your hard-working wife, drizzled with olive oil and sprinkled with sea salt, warm off a spoon. Bottom line? For the most versatile ricotta, stick with vinegar. Use lemon juice when a lemon flavor is appropriate, and avoid buttermilk unless you're really into it. Draining ricotta. To drain ricotta, place it in a fine mesh strainer lined with cheesecloth or a high-quality food-safe paper towel set over a bowl. The final texture of ricotta can vary greatly depending on how well it's drained. Pasteurized milk. Unless you're buying your milk at a farm or squeezing it straight from the teats of your own herd, you're getting pasteurized milk, milk that's been heated in order to destroy bacteria and prolong its shelf life. There are three basic methods used to do this. Regular pasteurized milk has been heated to 161 degrees Fahrenheit for around 20 seconds. This is the standard for most supermarket milks, which have a shelf life of a few weeks. Ultra-high temperature pasteurized milk has been heated much hotter, all the way up to 275 degrees Fahrenheit, for 1 second. It is labeled UHT, or ultra-pasteurized, and has a shelf life of several months. Many organic milk producers use this method of pasteurization, as it allows their milks to sit in supermarket dairy cases for longer. Organic milk often doesn't sell as quickly as regular milk. When packed into specially designed containers, UHT milk can actually keep, unrefrigerated, for months or even years. Low-temperature pasteurized milk has been held at 145 degrees Fahrenheit for 30 minutes. Many small farms pasteurize their milk with this method, as it doesn't produce the cooked flavor that UHT or regular pasteurized milk can have. The label generally doesn't indicate whether the milk is just pasteurized or if it's been low-temperature pasteurized, so unless you know the producer, chances are it's the former. As far as their cooking qualities go, in most applications, all of these types of milk will behave just about the same. For making ricotta, however, the higher the temperature the milk has been cooked to, the more breakdown you find in its proteins and sugars. For this reason, UHT milk tends to have a slightly sweeter flavor. Complex carbohydrates are broken down into simpler, sweeter sugars during the pasteurization process. And UHT milks will not coagulate as well when making ricotta. I recommend standard pasteurized milk, low-temperature pasteurized milk, or, if you can get it, raw milk. Waffles. Waffles are like the cool cousin of pancakes, a bit more complicated, a bit more interesting, and a bit crustier on the outside. But, deep down, they're almost identical. When we're talking quick, American-style waffles, as opposed to, say, a traditional slow-rising, yeasted, chewy Belgian waffle, we're talking a chemically leavened batter, just like with pancakes. but try throwing your pancake batter into a waffle iron and you will run into trouble. With pancakes, the steam evaporating as the pancakes cook has an easy escape route. You can see it coming out of the top of the pancakes as bubbles form. With a waffle trapped inside its metal cage, it's not so easy. Waffles made from pancake batter come out gummy, with a distinct lack of crispness. But I wanted to be able to start my waffles with my basic pancake mix so that I wouldn't have to keep two mixes on hand in my pantry. I realized the solution had to be twofold. I needed extra leavening power to help the waffles rise in their constrained environment, and I needed a method to ensure that they got crisp faster and stayed crisp. I first tried adding a little bit of extra baking powder and baking soda when I mixed up my batter. It helped with the texture, but with too much chemical leavening, that soapy metallic flavor started creeping in. I'd have to find a physical means to leaven my batter instead. I was already adding a good deal of bubbles with my whipped egg whites. What if I were to add even more in the form of soda water? It's a trick that New Englanders have used forever. The beer in beer-battered fish is just as much about the leavening powder of the bubbles as it is about the flavor of the ale. Even the Japanese use soda water to achieve an extra light tempura. Using soda water does cut back a little on the flavor of the waffles, but it's not too noticeable, and it's a compromise I'm willing to make in the name of superior texture. A dash of vanilla or orange liqueur or even maple extract and bacon, if you'd like, adds plenty of flavor to keep you distracted. It's important that you use ice-cold club soda. Cold liquids retain carbonation better, and you want the batter to stay as bubbly as possible until it starts cooking. Club soda is superior to seltzer water in this case because it contains sodium, which also helps it to retain its bubbles. Crispness is all about dehydration and the setting of proteins, both things that are accomplished through heat and time. The key to extra crisp waffles? Just cook them a little more slowly for a little bit longer. Not only does this lead to superior texture, it also serendipitously results in more even browning. Buttermilk biscuits. If my wife and I ever have identical twins, I'd like to name one Stanley and the other Evil Stanley for the purposes of scientific inquiry. We'll raise them exactly the same, but over time, Evil Stanley will undoubtedly begin to live up to his name because of a subtle difference in the way the world treats him.